don't have to apologize. Maybe she isn't here, so I don't have to apologize anymore. But I joke that I'm wavelength independent, but actually in this talk, I am going to be super microwave specific, so I am a bit of a frequencist.
What I like as being a...
Depending on how you speak to a data-minded theorist or a theory-informed observationalist.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. I like to constrain all the things. Some of the axiom results that I'm going to talk about for the sun signature are contained in this paper, and in fact, it's a little snapshot, because I challenge you to find something in this list that you do not. You're missing all my jokes? Damn. Also,
I think this might be God speaking.
Yes.
I'm ready to go. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, thank you.
Great. I challenge you, God, to find something in this list that you do not care about. No. Glad you guys can all hear it. The revolution is that from the ground, particularly with a cosmic macro background, we're really able to look at a wide range of physical scales because we're able to do both sort of B-mode science, but also small-scale CMB science, which tells you a lot about astrophysical interactions and different kinds of processes. And if you care about ultralight dark matter, it tells you about axions. Okay. So I'm going to give you a little brief introduction into the surveys themselves and then get back to the physics. I'm doing it kind of the wrong way around. But the Simons Observatory is a funded telescope that is an upgrade to two existing collaborations. It's being built in the Atacama Desert in Chile. And we're going to have two surveys, particularly because we want to hit both science cases, large scales and small scales. So on small scales, we're going to have a very large aperture survey that's designed to overlap maximally with ground-based experiments, because I do care about optical data as well. And so this allows kind of cross-correlation science. And we'll have multiple frequency bands, because if you care about CMB physics, as much as you love astrophysics, it gets in the way of your measurements. And so you need to have multiple frequencies to try and disentangle your foreground secondary emissions. And then we'll have a small aperture survey designed to go super deep on one patch of sky that we will then use to try and get estimates on the tensor to scalar ratio R. So that's about 10% of sky area. Oh, this is a picture of the site. It's high enough that you have to have oxygen, which is great, which means I've been working on the precursor to this telescope, the Atacama Cosmology Telescope, for 10 years, actually since I started my PhD, and they've always found reasons to not send me to site. I'm not saying that I would be useful, but it would be great. And so we're gonna have these two kinds of telescopes in a really ambitious combination of collaborations, because the name of the game at the moment is going forward, collaboration between groups, because we're really getting to pulling signals out of the noise, and so you have to combine forces and expertise and also cash to build bigger and better telescopes. Okay, what are one of the things that I want to do with small-scale CMB science? Well, I care about ultralight axions, and of course, Ismina is the pioneer of this string Axiverse. I found this fabulous photo. Everyone has to have one photo on the internet of them looking thoughtful, because people will want to screenshot it and put it into your talks. So all students everywhere, if there's no photo of you, they will take the worst Facebook photo of you that they can find. Luckily, Ismina knows this. Okay, so axions, of course, are not new. They originally were proposed to solve the CP problem, but the axions that I care about are motivated by string theory, and so we expect them to be distributed on a wide range of masses, and particularly to be very, very light. So they form the sort of ultralight particle, dark matter. So one of my main collaborators that I work on this with is David Marsh, who of course was a postdoc here at Perimeter. And of course you have to take a photo of yourself with a skateboard, right? And if you weren't online yesterday, you might have missed a paper that he wrote with the other David Marsh. They have conjectured the marshland, which lives between the swampland and the landscape. and they do a nice world line diagram, because they have continued to cross paths. David Marsh, number one, was at Oxford and then came here, and then David Marsh, two, went to Oxford. So anyway, it's great. But also, currently am working with two people who are in the room, so Harrison Winch and Alex Lagu, who you should definitely speak to because I flagrantly stole some of their work for my last two slides. And then Dan Grin at the top, who also has a lovely romantic photo of himself as a Haverford faculty member. And so we care about the kind of phenomenology of axions, what can we tell about axions with data, what new things should we be looking at, and how should we be changing our modeling of axion and axion physics to try and get at new probes as they become available. So I introduce these axions as being motivated by string theory and compactifications of extra dimensions, but really what I am saying is we have this scalar field sitting in a potential, and I model everything as a simple harmonic oscillator, and in fact I'm going to be even simpler than that and model things as fluids. But really, we are trying to see what this very light scalar field will do to observations and cosmological observables. Why should you care about axions? Well, because they're distributed on a wide range of scales, you know, everything from sort of 10 to the minus 3 eV to the cosmological ones are really 10 to the 30, minus 33 eV were the ones that I care about. It means that we can start to attack them from different probes, and it's not just related to the specific range that typically are quoted when people are thinking about the QCD axion. You should care about ultralight axions or ULAs because cosmologically it's we have the best handle on the on ways to constrain them. And also, while some people say there are no crises in cold dark matter, we're still all employed, which means there's got to be something wrong. Otherwise, we would be doing other things, unless you have moved on to other things, in which case, great. okay, so what do they actually do to cosmological observables? The key here is that the axion is sitting frozen in its potential, and so it's looking at early times until it starts coherently oscillating. It's looking like a dark energy component, so it has W of minus, close to minus one. And then the friction term in that harmonic oscillator is being provided by the Hubble expansion. So let's just go back to that. The friction term is being provided by the Hubble expansion, which of course is Hubble parameters changing. And so as the mass of the axion becomes comparable to the Hubble factor, it can start to coherently oscillate in its potential. And then it essentially switches from looking like a dark energy-like component frozen in its field, frozen in its potential, to looking like a dark matter component. And that's when all the interesting stuff happens. And that transition, which we aptly name AOSC, the scale factor at which it starts to oscillate, that is set by the mass of the axion. In this case, where we're talking about, you know, an M squared phi squared potential. So what it does is, once it starts oscillating, it has a scale-dependent sound speed, and it's suppressing structure on small scales. And so that leads to a kind of break or a step in the matter power spectrum, which I'm showing here. I am showing two different cases, because the neat thing about axion dark matter is that we, for some ranges of masses, we don't have strong constraints on the allowed upper bound. So if you think of people who try to say, well, how much of the universe could be made of warm dark matter? You can put pretty tight constraints on that. But with axions, you have to vary the mass range to see at what masses are we blind to axions as a dark matter component, and at what masses do we really know? And so you can already see here, from here, how we have some constraints. So I'll just take you through this plot. The top green slash purple dashed line is the lambda CDM case, which is almost completely mimicked by an axion with a mass of around 10 to the minus 24 electron volt. And all of these, the plots here on the right, are showing you axion where I've allowed the axions to be 100% of the total dark content. So I say the total dark content is cold dark matter plus axion dark matter. And then as I change the mass of the axion, this suppression is happening at different times because the axions have started oscillating at different times. If they start oscillating really early, so they go from dark energy-like to dark matter-like very early, by the time the CMB happens or by the time galaxies form, they just look like normal cold dark matter. Excuse me, and that's not a problem. If they start oscillating later, then they essentially are able to suppress structure. In this case, we have that I'm changing the allowed fraction at fixed mass of the axions. And so you see the, you know, most suppression, again, for as you increase the axion fraction. So we want to understand this is a theory plot. We need error bars to make me happy, data points and error bars to make me happy. And as we start to get data, we need to consider degeneracies between different parameters, because we know that neutrinos also suppress structure on small scales, of course, with a completely different physical mechanism. So axions are not warm. They come from this axion field, and so it's non-thermal. And so even though the suppression, you can relate the scales at which the axions are going to suppress structure, and it's similar to the scales at which neutrinos will do it, but in this case, it's really suppressing structure below the gene scale, whereas neutrinos have this free streaming scale, so it's a little bit different. But one of the things we did in a recent paper is try to see, are there differences between them, and how could we, in a universe in which I just want to know, do we have neutrinos, and I also want to know, do we have axions, how can I tell the two apart, and what are their signatures? This nice schematic plot, which I apparently stole without attribution from my colleague, David Marsh, one of the Marshlands. You can see here, this is where we've solved for the field evolution kind of correctly. We've really solved the field equations. And you see this exact oscillation starting to occur at this AOSC, this oscillation scale, which occurs when the Hubble scale and the mass are roughly equal. And then your equation of state starts looking, instead of like being like dark energy, it starts oscillating wildly up and down with an average of around zero. So the key thing that we actually do, because we're interested in computing things like Markov chain Monte Carlo constraints, which means I can't solve the field equations at every step. What I instead do is I map two fluids at a certain transition. So I take the time at which oscillation makes sense or begins to occur, and then I just approximate this as a fluid with a dark matter-like fluid. And that works because it means CAM takes, 3 seconds instead of 2 minutes to run, which is excellent. One of the cool things about this as a statistical problem is that you have a degeneracy because you have at some masses, axions look like dark matter, and at some masses, they look like dark energy. You have a degeneracy direction that changes as a function of mass. So in this plot, I've output some chains for you, and you can see exactly that. So this, I'm showing the axion energy density and the cold dark matter energy density. And if we now color the all of our Markov chain Monte Carlo points by a certain mass, you'll notice when axions are very light, they remain frozen for the history of the universe. And so they're in no way degenerate with dark matter because they look like a dark energy component. And so the degeneracy between axions and dark matter is essentially nil. However, as soon as we change them to being more massive, and I like how in my world massive is 10 to the minus 22 EV, but the most massive axions, you can see the degeneracy is 1:1. And we can actually get away with almost no cold dark matter density if we have these axions, which is pretty neat. The interesting region is sort of the fuzzy region where they're about 10 to the minus 25, 10 to the minus 26 EV, and that's where the degeneracy is not complete, and one might actually put pretty good constraints. Okay, so these are the constraints that we had up until recently. These are the Planck constraints, and again, this is sort of the same degeneracy that is illustrated again here, where we have almost perfect degeneracy with dark matter. So this is the total, the axion energy density as a fraction of the total. So it should go to unity in the dark matter case, which is true for axions around 10 to the minus 24 EV. And then they're also degenerate with dark energy for light masses. But this sweet spot, we have limits of around 2% on the axion energy density, which is pretty neat. And that's the area that we are hoping to make a lot of progress on going forward. Spoiler alert, we do. These are just 1D distributions. I won't labor the point. We are now building up for things like the Simons Observatory and also for future experiments. And so the first thing you want to do is say, well, how well can I tell the difference going forward? So in this case, I did just a Fisher matrix forecast where I assumed, let me set the axion density to be the upper bound that we have at the most constrained mass region. So you see I've just fixed it at around 2%. Of course, on the left and the right of this graph, it could be anything, but we just fix it at 2%. And you notice a few things. So this is Planck basically giving us the result that we had or before. But we much improve this. In fact, we can go from constraints now where we only have an upper bound on of about 2% to ruling out anything greater than 2% at more than 10 sigma. So we basically just smash all of our constraints out of the water, which is excellent if you want to rule out axions.
This is marginalized over neutrinos.
This is marginalized over neutrinos. Yeah, yeah.
Is there some mass range which is most degenerate?
I'll show you that next, yeah. The sad part is, of course, there is a region in which we're still pretty ignorant. So the most massive ones look the most like cold dark matter, and so we know the least. But we can try and look at constraints on smaller scales to try and constrain those a little bit more. And this is where a lot of energy has focused recently. Yes, so here's the degeneracy direction. So we did a forecast for CMB stage 4, which is even the next survey after the Simons Observatory, which is looking for funding right now. And you'll see, so this is residual plots of the temperature, polarization, and lensing power spectra. And you'll see there are two lines, a dashed and a solid in each case. Now, the dashed is axions and the dashed are neutrinos and the solid are axions. So yes, they are very degenerate. But the interesting thing is that the current neutrino bounds for some of these are already basically ruled out. And so the degeneracies are not necessarily the same for all masses. You can see that a little bit more here. So here I'm showing the degeneracy between the axion fraction and some of the neutrino masses. And as we change axion masses from 10 to the minus 25, which is the black line, to 10 to the minus 31, which is the more dark energy-like axions, the degeneracy with massive neutrinos decreases. Basically the degeneracy comes about because axions suppress structure. Neutrinos do the same thing, but they also do it because you're basically taking away matter that's relativistic early on. And so you suppress structure because you have less cold dark matter. And so axions do a similar thing, which is why the degeneracy exists at a range of scales. In this case, that's interesting. I almost explained the opposite of the plot that I would have, I need to think about this more. I would have expected the degeneracy to be stronger for more massive ones, but there you go. Turns out physics is very cool and interesting. So looking forward, we can move. So I kept showing the plots with the little, you know, where I had done a Fisher matrix, assuming some true value, and my colleagues who are more interested in kind of particle limits exclusion regions got very upset because they're like, you don't know anything fundamental about the axion density, so let's make a different plot. And so I listened, and this plot is the bound, the maximum axion mass, sorry, the maximum axion fraction as a function of mass that you would rule out with future experiments. So you can see the Planck black area, we're ruling out much less. You can have much higher axion fractions. And then we have Planck and SO, the Simons Observatory, and then Planck and S4, which will improve constraints. We're still struggling a little bit on the 10 to the minus 20, 3 to the minus 24 EVs. They're cold. It's a problem. They look as close to dark matter as we could, and so we need to think of other constraints, particularly on very small scales, looking at nonlinearities, and also trying to understand things like smaller objects.
Renee,
yeah.
You've chosen a y-axis range that makes it look that these different lines are, of course, quite far apart. Is there any reason to think that there isn't a big space much below, which is as likely as the space that you're showing in the plot, where it would be completely undetectable? Are you really biting at a big chunk of where it is reasonable that these theories might live?
Oh, so you're saying what if actually all of the axion predictions live around here? That's a really good question. No, I mean, to be fair, most people, well, there isn't a huge prior on what we expect the density to be. So we have been pretty agnostic about that. Once you start actually thinking of potentially other constraints, for example, if you start adding in significant isocurvature from significant detections of R, if they happen, then you can start making very strong priors on what omega should be. But in the absence of additional signatures, we don't really have a prior. So in the last few minutes, I know I want to make sure there's time for questions. I wanted to just chat to you about new avenues, because this is work that's ongoing, at the sort of inference level, but of course we want to try and attack axions from different directions. So working with some students, I've been thinking through some of these things. So Alex, who's here, has been thinking about, well, how can we do more than just the linear clustering? So all of the power spectrum plots I showed you was just linear. And so Alex has been looking at incorporating axionic or fuzzy dark matter type effects into LPT, so into actually understanding how we can do nonlinear clustering. And particularly he's been working because everyone needs to be connected all the time. We've been looking at peak patch simulation suite and seeing if we can actually look at what is the clustering like of these objects. But Alex, like every good graduate student, decided to come up with a great toy model kind of instruction to see how can we compare the clustering that we would get from, or the growth really, of fuzzy dark matter compared to just this typical CDM case and then baryons. And so in this toy model, you have the density field. You should correct me if I say anything wrong because I stole these slides from you. by the way, always have your students make slides to update you, because then when you need to steal in the middle of the night, you can just do so. So the color gives you the density field, and then the arrows are giving you the velocity field, which is really neat because we can start to use these constraints and these forecasts to actually say, can we measure different features that are would tell us something about axions, like a KZ effect that's modified by the axion velocity, or by the modification to the velocity because of axions, which is really neat. So with another student, Harrison, we've been looking at can we actually start to be a little bit more correct in the way we expand and understand the axions. So I showed you this m squared, phi squared potential that generates these equations of motion. But really, we actually expect you to have, in general, you expect to have this periodic kind of cosine potential that we just approximate it by m squared, phi squared for a large value of the symmetry breaking scale FA. But Harrison has been looking at what if we actually relaxed that assumption, and so you now have a truly cosine potential. Now you have to be a little bit careful. So what we did in the fluid solution is we said, oh, we can just compute the mass of axion, compute the value of the Hubble parameter in something like CAM. When they're roughly equal, you just switch from going dark energy to dark matter. Now you actually don't have that simple relationship, and you really need to follow the field until you notice that it starts oscillating in its potential. And when that actually starts to happen, you can safely make the transition between your two fluid solutions. And there's some amazing detective work that has almost broken him, but not quite broken him, in understanding just some of the numerical approximations we were making inside CAM, where we were either switching over too soon, and then you're left with, you know, additional energy in the oscillating field, or making sure that you actually are turning over to your fluid solution when your equation of state is truly, you know, zero, as opposed to like switching over when W is a half or something, because then you get just a very strange cosmological component, and that leads to lots of weirdness. Why do we want to do this at all, you might ask, other than it's cool? Well, we want to understand there, you know, people are looking at constraints on axions based on Lyman alpha. And one of the things we want to understand is some folks have modeled that they actually see a small enhancement in the matter power on certain scales depending on axion parameters for 10 to the minus 22 eV axions. And if this is something we really want to try and constrain, we need to be able to model it. We realized that our current treatment didn't actually allow us to see this at all because we had such a high value of FA. And so now the question is, as we relax that, can we put constraints on what the symmetry breaking scale is of these axions? And similarly, do we see any of these enhancements? At the moment, the take-home message is we kind of do, but we don't see the expected magnitude of this little blip that folks are seeing on very small scales. You know, so this is K over H around, you know, 10 to the 1. So that's something interesting, and we're trying to both reproduce other people's results, but also understand within our own formalism what are our constraints on FA on the symmetry breaking scale.
This is the linear power spectrum you're plotting here?
This is still linear.
Okay.
Yeah. Of course, the two projects eventually can be combined, right? That you actually do the two things together. But great. I think that's basically all I have. I wanted to just do another little pitch. Or another little advertisement for the Simons Observatory, in the sense that it's a great groundbreaking experiment that is going to start taking data really, really rapidly. And in order to do that, we of course need more hands and arms and eyes to do analysis. But hopefully you will now all switch to working on axions with me, as opposed to all switching on working on axions without me, against me. Yeah, no, I'm kidding. But hopefully, yeah, you have understood why, assuming that there is no preferred value for the axion energy density, we can put constraints on future, from future experiments, and that we're trying to explore these degeneracies a little bit more and try to push in to the wall of uncertainty, as I like to call it, on both sides. And this will be made even more impressive as we get to small scale measurements of lensing, the CMB lensing, power spectrum, galaxy lensing, and other probes of really the as far down into the tail as we can get. So thanks.
Primary improvements in constraining power come from the lensing reconstruction, or where is it?
Yeah, you can see here.
Or in the lensing?
Yeah, you can see here it's largely lensing. So this is the kappa-kappa. We do actually pretty well with TE because you can also get further down the tail and the foregrounds are less, but really it's lensing. Although, interestingly enough, it's a mix of it's not just lensing depth, it's like sky area as well. So the naive constraints that I've computed for, there was a pitch to build this CMB HD, so a smaller patch of sky but going to a very, very large L. I don't get significantly better constraints over a slightly shallower but larger sky. But actually, this, in order, if you want to speak about this, you should definitely speak to Victor, who's looking at small scale lensing, who doesn't have a photo up here, but great.
You mentioned the Lyman alpha constraints on the axon to refine the signature, maybe a compression or something. I'm aware of the warm dark matter constraints, which I think the SPSS and other people have been doing with Lyman alpha. So is this related to that? Do they know how to solve the degeneracy, or do they have some way around that?
let's see. A lot, each group that looks at Lyman alpha typically make semi-independent analysis choices and assumptions, as we have done and will do, I imagine. So in terms of the, typically folks either concentrate strongly on warm dark matter or on like fuzzy dark matter. And so in this case, I don't think that they've solved the degeneracy.
So it could have been the warm, I mean, I wasn't sure if the warm dark matter constraints, which I'm aware of, are the same data set was used or.
They're the same, yeah. So actually, you can, if you just look at those kinds of constraints, then the thing that's neat is that you push from the opposite direction. You say that you can't be heavier than a certain mass. And so actually what we're doing is like, you know, this side we're going 10 to the minus 24, this side you're going to 10 to the minus 22, 21, whatever. And so eventually you will be able to hopefully rule out rule it out as cold dark matter, which is great.
Can you say a little about the different assumptions that different groups are making on the
Lyman alpha? Well, one of the issues, which is why we're sort of starting to look at that, is just how you do the modeling of the nonlinearities. I mean, Lyman alpha is, you know, only really weakly nonlinear, which is good, but still you have to worry because, you know, as a trivial example, if you use something like HaloFit in this fuzzy dark matter context, which is the standard, you know, nonlinear formalism, you just get total rubbish signals. They're just huge. The opposite of suppression, which is enhancement, just huge enhancement, which doesn't make any sense. And that's even if you do use that to do kind of nonlinear lensing. And so we need to be really careful in the way that we model the additional effects that you'd get from nonlinearities. One of the things that Alex is finding is that in terms of the clustering, the biggest effect is really the modification of the initial conditions that then turns into additional suppression. So we're not actually seeing, if we add axionic terms to the kind of LPT formalism, we're not seeing any huge enhancement of or suppression of clustering relative to the case where you just take the standard formalism and you modify the initial conditions, which perhaps everyone expected, but I was hoping I'd just see this giant signal. I'd be like, great, Nobel Prize. Okay, you didn't have to laugh. John.
You predict dark matter halos. And these halos have to fit the galaxy rotation curves. So there's a paper by Blum et al. He gave a talk here recently.
Kfir? Kfir Blum?
Which he excluded actions with a mass of 10 to the minus 21 electron volts, because you get a big cusp near the cores of galaxies.
Right. So that's axions that are heavier than that, right?
That what?
That are heavier than 10 to the minus 21. Exactly. So so that's the thing. So we're excluding the ones that are lighter. And so the ones that are heavier, you're starting to meet in the middle. Unfortunately, there's still this range where you're okay. But that's what we're hoping to pincer, basically.
So the feature about that particular paper is that those actions produce predictions different from WIMPs.
Yeah.
So that makes them interesting.
Yeah.
Otherwise, the actions for larger mass look like WIMPs.
No, for sure. These are my guys. Yeah, totally.
So we do have a lot of problems fitting WIMPs.
I love WIMPs, but I prefer these guys. These are my... Cool, thanks. Yes.
Are you taking a look at the impact on other cosmological parameters when you're saying that for certain masses, axions are behaving like dark energy in the early universe? There are these early dark energy models that try to resolve the Hubble tension. And is there any impact on the other parameters?
So I haven't looked at this specifically, but there are people like Tanvi Karwal who actually look at the H-naught tension in the context of these axions. They modify the potential slightly so that you actually can have this, you know, slightly wonky, different values of H-naught at different times. We haven't done that explicitly, but Dan Grin is collaborators with them and Kaminkowski and Tanvi. So, yeah. I mean, axions can do basically everything you want. But not that I'm a salesperson. Just.
Any more questions for Renee? Yeah, please.
I worry about a theory which would put dark matter and dark energy on the same system at once, particularly because the so-called dark energy, I mean, it looks like a cosmological constant, it's on the borderline of violating energy conditions. And it's something which looks completely different from an ordinary physical field.
So it definitely can't be the same. It can't be both for one axion. So I should have made that clear. Each of these are individually estimated. Different kinds of axions, and they can't be all things to all women. Yeah. I mean, folks, there are people that look at coupling of these fields and how they might, you know, how they might be coupled and how different you would have a sort of spectrum of fields, but each one is doing its own job. I think it's lunch now.
I think that's right.
Okay.
Thanks again, Renee.